I freely grant that boon, and I'll repeat my plight from morn to afternoon, from afternoon to night, from 7 o'clock to two, from two to evening meal, from twilight to midnight, from twilight to midnight, at compact I win the sea.
Prisoner, we sought his cell in duty bound, the double grating spoken word, no prisoner, let all be found.
We hunted high,
we hunted low,
we hunted here,
we hunted there. The man we sought with anxious care had vanished into empty air. The man we sought with anxious care had vanished into empty air.
Stoning you!
prisoner fled. My life shall forfeit be instead. My lord, I did not set him free. I hate the man my rivalry.
The prisoner gone, I mourn again.
My life shall forfeit be instead.
I could have helped him to a spare.
My lord, I did not set him free.
Indeed, I can't imagine how. I've no idea at all. Have you?
Of his escape, not his escape. The chocolate must have been at work.
What? I am not
Your anguish sink. Oh, woe is me, I rather think. Oh, woe is me, I rather think. Yes, woe is me, I rather think. What every time you are his bride, and I am left alone bereft. Yes, woe is me, I rather think. Yes, woe is me, I rather think. Yes, woe is me, yes, woe is me, yes, woe is me.
Well and truly thickened, we come to the end of Act One of Gilbert and Sullivan's opera, considered by many to be their greatest, The Yeomen of the Guard, whose first run at the Savoy Theatre began in October 1888 and lasted for 423 performances. In tonight's semi-stage performance at the Royal Albert Hall as part of the 2012 prom season, Lisa Milne sang the role of Elsie and Andrew Kennedy, Colonel Fairfax. Mark Stone was Jester Jack Point, Dame Felicity Palmer was Dame Carruthers, housekeeper of the tower, and Mark Richardson was Sergeant Merrill. Toby Stafford Allen was jailer and tormentor Wilfred Shadbolt, Lee Melrose was Lieutenant of the Tower Sir Richard Chumley, and Heather Shipp was Phoebe Merrill. Tom Randall was Leonard Merrill, and Mary Bevan, seen rather than heard so far, was Kate, niece to Dame Carruthers. The BBC singers expanded in number to 36, made a very capable, roistering crowd, even if they did do it from a standing position. And the BBC Concert Orchestra was conducted by Jane Glover. The performance was directed by Martin Duncan, with choreography by Steve Elias, and costumes supervised by Estelle Butler. Now don't forget, you can follow us on Twitter, guess what, at BBC Proms, or tweet your own thoughts with the hashtag #BBCProms. I'm not really Twitter fluent yet. I shall be soon, and we'll pick up your messages. Perhaps you may have thoughts to refute what I'm going to say now, which is that I think Verdi would have wanted to lay claim to quite a lot of that material. But isn't it bliss that Sullivan studs the music with delicious little archaisms to remind us of Merry England? I'm in heaven, and I do hope you are too. Now, the audience is going out to refresh itself for the dramas to come, and it's time for our interval. Every Sunday during the proms season, we've been hearing from historian Dr. Lucy Worsley, who's been investigating some of the quirkier bits of local history to be found near the Royal Albert Hall. This evening, we find her at the Royal Geographical Society, which is literally just round the corner.
We are metres away from the Albert Hall in the Royal Geographical Society's building. I'm with Alistair MacLeod, who's the head of collections, and he's brought out for me rather an intriguing box that says on it, Mary Kingsley's hat. Now, I know that she's a famous female Victorian explorer. Where exactly did she go?
She was travelling in West Africa, and she's probably, to put her in context, she's the niece of Charles Kingsley, who wrote The Water Babies and various other books. And she was able to travel following the death of her father and her mother. So she had money and the opportunity, and she travelled primarily for the what is now the Natural History Museum to collect specimens of fish.
I've read that it was her job to collect fish and fetish.
That's correct.
That's a lovely little combination, isn't
but
it?
But we have none of those parts of the collection here. We have her hat.
Her personal hat. Let's have a look at this then. It looks like a lovely little plush cushion. It's furry, it's velvety, isn't it?
Now,
why would she have been wearing that in the Congo? Presumably she wouldn't.
She did.
Really?
She did. She was uncommonly fond of wearing the dress that she would have worn in London at the time. And she was very anti the suffrage movement. She didn't believe at all in the rights of women in that way. She wanted to prove herself as a woman by her experience and the knowledge that she brought back from West Africa. So very many of the photographs you see of her are wearing this hat.
Smell it. You can smell the sweat that must have impregnated
yes,
it after wearing it in the jungle. Actually, she tells a story about how the fact that she was wearing a big long skirt saved her life.
It did, yes. When she was walking through an area of jungle, she fell into a man trap, which was full of probably 6 or 8 foot poles, which had been sharpened at the end. So anybody who fell into the pit would almost certainly die. And because she was wearing her voluminous petticoats and her grey starched dress, she landed on them, but she sort of bounced slightly off the top of them, and it saved her life.
It is excellent health and safety gear, isn't it? Wear a great big skirt and you will not be killed by man traps.
That's right. But this hat is actually, it may smell of sweat, it may smell of something else. When she was in a tribal village, she was put into a hut, and she noticed there was a bag suspended from the rafters in the hut, and she took off a hat and emptied the contents of the bag into her hat, because she was a very curious individual, and it was full of small body parts. So it contained thumbs, a couple of eyeballs, a couple of shriveled hands. And these, because she was in a cannibalistic society, these were mementos that had been saved. So these were cannibals who'd eaten friendly rather than foe and decided to keep these as souvenirs.
No way! And she emptied them out of the bag into her
into
hat.
That very hat.
Into this very hat.
Into that very hat.
That's unbelievable. I can see why you let me hold it now and you didn't touch it. Right, so there's the hat going back into its box. And then all around us here we've got these blue books which give a clue to what explorers do in the evenings when they're not exploring,
yes,
right?
Yes, that's right, yeah.
What are all of these?
Well, this is a very precious set of copies of the South Polar Times. And the South Polar Times was the brainchild of Captain Robert Falcon Scott, who led 2 Antarctic expeditions. He led the Discovery Expedition between 1901 and 1904, and then the Terra Nova, the Tragic Expedition between 1910 and 1913. And as a Royal Naval officer, he saw the value of, if you like, enhancing what would be a kind of fairly starchy naval journal, which was kept on all naval ships, by encouraging all of the crew and the officers, the expeditionary team, to contribute to a kind of onboard newspaper.
Because presumably they had quite long stretches of time when they were stuck in the ice, when there was nothing else for them to do.
Indeed. They had 3 months when they would be in total darkness. And you've opened the page there at
about cooking
on sledge cookers. So the contributions are very varied. There are poems, there are
songs, pictures.
There are diary pages telling you a little bit more about what they had recently done. If there was a particularly important dinner, they would include the menu from the dinner. And also, it was a way of sharing scientific information, because it was really the very first scientific expedition in Antarctica, which led on to so much contemporary science, and they would share their findings. In fact, you've opened it
there.
Birds. These are beautiful.
Oh, these are emperor penguins.
Yeah, they are indeed.
Paintings of them.
And the great thing about this set is that, of course, it had the lowest circulation of any newspaper in history, because there's only one set produced, and this is Captain Scott's set. And all of the colour illustrations that you see have all been painted onto the page.
Now, all of these items that you've got in your pretty vast collection here, they take their turn in the showcase out there and people can come into the society and look at them, is that right?
They do. We have over 2 million items here. Probably the biggest portion of our collection is our collection of maps, atlases and charts. We've got the world's largest private collection. And they're all fully accessible to everybody. We're open between 10 and 5 p.m. Monday to Friday. And everybody from school children through to researchers can come and use them and see them as you've just seen them here.
And Lucy Worsley will be back next week with more historical treats from Albertopolis. Sitting with me now is my special guest for the evening, and we're already talking 19 to the dozen, as you may have gathered. Actor and director Fiona Shaw is here at the Royal Albert Hall for Yeoman of the Guard this evening. She's, I don't need to tell you, but I'm going to anyway, one of the great talents of her generation. Let's see if I can make her blush in the gloaming. Fiona has bagged several Olivier Awards, huge acclaim for roles in Brecht and Beckett, and is also, of course, well known to millions as the nasty Aunt Petunia in the Harry Potter films. But you're in nice mode this evening, aren't you, Fiona?
Well, yes, me and many others. I mean, the whole crowd here are having a lovely time, but also I think the orchestra are having a good time. It's rather lovely to see Jane Glover putting them through their paces and them enjoying it, and she enjoying it too.
Yeah, I mean, the first act just sped by for me.
Just marvellous. I thought from the moment the overture started, you knew that you were in for a treat, and we have been.
Well, I don't think there's a person in this hall who hasn't got a first Gilbert and Sullivan memory. It's so that the team G and S are so sort of in the national DNA, and I've just got to add, a lady from the audience just approached me before you came in to tell me that her grandparents, Marjorie Eyre and Leslie Rands, were with the Doyley Cart Company for 30 years. Oh. She sang Phoebe. She was a Phoebe specialist, and he was a Jack Point. And I'm sure there'll be listeners tonight who will know those names. And the lady to whom I spoke just now has the spinning wheel prop from Act One. Gosh. So that's really quite a connection. I think everybody has got some sort of story, although perhaps not as good as that one. My first memory is The Gondoliers, performed by a local amateur company at the Coventry Hippodrome, with the man across the road, Derek, playing the clarinet in the Volunteer Orchestra. What's yours? I believe Trial by Jury gets
absolutely in. The firmament of my life was started by Trial by Jury. I played it at school and I sang the judge, you know, all the legal fury sees you, no proposals to treat you, I can't sit up here all day, I must want to get away, barristers, new attorneys, set out on your homeward journeys. I mean, and it was a wonderful game to the end of The Omen Tonight, of the first act, and hearing, of course, the hurry, you know, the kind of absolutely gymnastics of the speed of the libretto, and they always give you a good treat with those.
Well, it's quite a double threat thing to have to do, isn't it? I mean, we're in the Albert Hall, which is much bigger than the Savoy Theatre in any of its incarnations, and they're not only having to act, move, sing, dance a little, but they've got to cope with the crisp diction you need.
They have. Well, you've got lovely Lee Melrose and, of course, Mary Bevan, both of whom I've worked with at the NO, and they're used to this, you know, overly large house for something that you're trying to communicate to a group of friends. But they've all got terribly good at it. It's really remarkable. And I can barely see the people up at the back row of here, and you see these little dots, but they stand still. And they've all got splendid speaking voices as well as singing voices.
So. Well, I'm glad that you are phrasing
them for that. About it, but they're doing well.
Would you accept an invitation to direct a Gilbert and Sullivan opera?
Well, I'm not sure. Funny enough, I was watching even tonight. I was thinking, listening. I thought they're not here yet really deconstructible. They actually are part much more of our childhoods. I mean, my brother playing, you know, in the Mikado with his rugby boots and singing, you know, Three Little Maids from School is one of the funniest things I can remember in my life. But I'm not sure that there's a way quite yet of really reinventing them. But if there were, I would love it. I think you have to be very politically astute. You have to have a very strong view of what it is, whether yeomen are really, you know, the prison officers of today. I'm not sure whether that's being viewed. But what is being looked at, and it would be a very good thing to investigate, is the way in which most people in our society are helpless beyond the rank that you serve. And that remains true today, whether you're a yeoman or whether you're in society.